Welcome, everyone. This is another Risky Business News sponsored interview. I'm Tom Uren, and today I have Jacob Torrey, who is the head of labs at Thinxt. Now, I've been looking at the pre-release of the latest Thinkscapes that's just come out. And I should explain that Thinkscapes is a collation of, what would you describe it as, the most interesting security research in the last quarter?
Yeah, I mean, basically we spend weeks going through, I think this episode I reviewed almost 800 talks and papers and blogs from around the internet. And then I've distilled them down into either maybe something that's brand new that I've never seen before, or something where I'm starting to see momentum around some type of new research subfield or area that I think is worth pointing that kind of tipping point where it's gone from one or two lone wolves to something where you're starting to see university labs or other groups kind of really kind of coalesce around something.
And I see that you've broken down the latest Thinkscapes into different themes, and one of them is privacy. It really struck me that you've spent a lot of time trying to make research accessible. So the themes is one aspect of that. You know, you can dive into what you like, but also each, it's really a nice little vignette of why I should care about any particular piece of research. So congratulations, that's a lot of work. So did you have a particular favorite?
I mean, they're all pretty high bar to be included. And I think, you know, there's a lot of great work that wasn't included either because it didn't quite meet the bar or otherwise, was maybe too similar to something else. But I think if I had to pick, the one that got me the most excited was actually a privacy one, ZK Creds. It's some work looking at using some of this underlying cryptography from zero knowledge proofs that's been used in some of the kind of anonymous cryptocurrencies. There's been a lot of work in zero knowledge proofs lately. There was a large DARPA effort run by a friend of mine, Josh Barron, that put a lot of effort into making, you know, zero knowledge much more powerful and useful. And we're starting to see the benefits from that. So this is essentially a privacy preserving identity scheme where you can anchor a digital identity to something real. In this case, they're able to essentially verify the signature of the digital part of your passport. And then from that, they can then essentially prove various attributes about you. So for example, you're over a certain age or you're a citizen of a certain country without revealing any other information or even what that backing document is. So if you had, say, a document that was a passport and a driver's license, you could combine those two together and then they won't even know necessarily what organization, just as one of the ones that it trusts. And so that's something that I found shocking because there's really no non-digital analog of that. You can't have I'm more than 21 years old and I can drink that doesn't have my name or my picture or my address on it that is also unforgeable and I can't, you know, lend to a friend to get into a bar. And so I think that was something that was kind of a really impressive digital-only capability that really stuck out at me.
Yeah, I saw that and I was wondering about in terms of governments. You know, these technologies exist, but they don't actually care that much about implementing them. So in the Australian example, when it came to COVID, there was a COVID digital proof of vaccination. And it was basically kind of just an image, a bit more than just an image, but there was a government database that supported it, but it definitely didn't bother with any of the zero knowledge or privacy preserving stuff. So perhaps the application isn't in government?
Yeah, so that's what's kind of was neat about this is that they could route it to, for example, a signature by a government, but it doesn't have to be with that government having to, you know, actually sign anything other than what they already do as part of the passport. So you can use that to bootstrap. There was some work previously we featured that was based around a lot of work in the Netherlands. They're building similarly kind of privacy preserving digital identities. So you can, for example, have your kind of permanent government record that you could then use when you're applying for a job to prove that you actually have a certain degree, but then you could redact other fields that weren't relevant to that specific application or for that use case. And you could do all of that kind of in an offline mode, which, you know, helped kind of pull the government part of it out of the loop. This goes one step further, and now there is no kind of initial government step where they have to create this system. and it's dynamic enough that you can create these attributes or things you care about, like age or expiration dates, and you can use those after the fact. So it doesn't have to be something where you kind of have a static description of what you want when you start the process. So it makes it easier to adapt to changing, you know, legal requirements. I know their example was, I guess in a lot of countries, maybe Australia as well, they're looking at kind of mandating age verification before looking at adult content online. And that's not something you really want to be giving your home address and, you know, a picture of you holding up your ID. And so this was kind of one of their examples of this could be something where you could essentially prove that you were over a certain age and you were a citizen of a certain country, but they don't know who you are necessarily.
Right. Once again, porn driving forward technology. what struck me is that it's a lot of work to put together this. You've done a good job. Why does Thinkst invest all this time and effort into Thinkscapes?
Yeah, so it's a pretty cool story. So it started out when Thinkst got started. It was a paid service. So I believe that's kind of how Haroon and Marco did some bootstrapping. So it used to be, I think, $10,000 a year for a quarterly subscription. And then eventually, once they got the Canary product going, they kind of stopped it. A bunch of people were upset, kind of, hey, we want to keep paying you for this because it helps us. It's a ton of work, as you said, but you know, someone's got to do it. And so now that we're doing well enough with the Canary and that's our main focus, we can now bring this back as kind of a public service. I think it's, you know, it's a shame for how much research doesn't get picked up by larger journalism or news. And I think also it helps kind of find different people doing different siloed work. So one thing we do, if we find work that is similar or at least kind of related, we may group them together. And then I do send usually a note to those authors saying, hey, you know, here's another paper, another group at a different lab that's doing something similar. I don't know if you want to collaborate, but, you know, here's kind of, you know, something that, you know, kind of bridge those connections. So that's kind of why I do it. There was a program at DARPA, Big Mechanism, that was looking at machine reading. And the idea was there's so much academic research that we don't have enough time to read all of those papers and then be able to understand the sum of our knowledge. And so while this is a much more manual and much smaller budget effort than that, this is essentially us trying to figure out, like, what is the sum of our knowledge? And the themes, I think, are interesting to watch over time. So this is coming up on 2 years now, but we kind of look back a year in review after we launched this. So I think next quarter should be our second full cycle with the reboot. And we'll look back and see, did we miss any trends? Did we miss any research fields that were getting a lot of attention? And I think that's, you know, another nice thing with these themes is you can kind of figure out, like, where is the research community investing, maybe where are there opportunities, and maybe where you don't want to try to go head to head with a lot of existing kind of top tier research.
Yeah. So how does this kind of give you an impression of where the next big thing is? I mean, I guess just in the last month or so, there's been quite a lot of, maybe even more 6 months, things like different cloud vulnerabilities where there's a tension between what the cloud provider is doing and should or could be doing and what is visible to people. Is that a new hot field in that it's not a theme in this quarter?
Yeah, so we featured a lot of the confidential computing. So there's been both work by the cloud providers as well as some of the open source community at looking at how do you use some of the technologies like AMD, SMV, SMP, which is essentially a way where you can take a Kubernetes container or a VM and have it fully encrypted by the hardware, where any memory that leaves the cache is encrypted by the CPU with a key that it never kind of leaves that enclave. So you can create essentially VMs that are completely opaque to the hypervisor. And there's actually like a key signature exchange between the guest and the CPU, and the hypervisor is kind of locked out of that. And so certainly, you know, you have to trust your cloud provider for availability. They can just turn the server off or fail to schedule you. But in terms of confidentiality, integrity, there's a lot of really exciting research that's just starting to come. I mean, I think Intel delayed their TDX, which is their version of SVM. And so it's just starting to come out pretty soon. But there's a lot of work in that, like how do we kind of deprivilege hypervisors and the people that run them? Because I think there is kind of this concern is that you are offloading you know, not only your data, but in many cases, your entire business to a third party that, you know, has some of its own motivations.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. I was also thinking in terms of not necessarily compute resources, but services as well. The example I've been thinking of was just in the last couple of weeks where a Chinese crew got hold of a Microsoft key and was able to abuse that.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen that in the news and I've heard it here on Risky Business. I would say that there's a lag between kind of what you see in the research field of kind of the art of the possible and then what you see kind of operationalized, or at least what is publicly operationalized.
Right.
I mean, we featured some work that was using magnetic fields to be able to extract the AI neural network layout. GPUs, essentially, when they use power to load those neural architectures into them, it's actually something that they were able to signature with close to 100% accuracy. So if you could pay someone at your local cloud provider to stand there with an electromagnetic sensor, you know, all of $3, you could essentially steal their AI network architecture, build a black box, and then train an adversarial attack against it with much higher performance. So again, that's kind of a Mission Impossible style thing. I'm not sure when we'll hear about that on Risky Business as something that's actually happened. But I mean, even in this issue, there is this magnetic backdoor where they're able to use electromagnets to essentially vibrate a speaker that's tightly embedded with a microphone. So imagine your phone to be able to do something like, hey, Alexa, unlock the door, or hey, Siri, send a text message, all just through a kind of a magnetic field at standoff distance.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that research, and it's funny because if that was the sort of thing that happened in a Mission Impossible movie, you'd probably go, ah, they're making that up. But no. So I understand that Thinxt Lab also is working on something called Thinxt Citations. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Thinkscapes is coupled with Citation, so citation.thinxt.com, which is essentially our free, open, collaborative hacker bibliography. So we have, I think, somewhere in the order of 70,000 talks that we've been recording since the early 90s. And, you know, some of it is just the title and the author. Some of it is everything with links to the talks and the videos and everything. And so that's something else that we're building. We've just redone it. It used to be called CC. Oh, yeah, it looks like we're at 70,000 talks and 65,000 speakers spanning over almost 3,000 conferences.
That's a lot of talks.
Yeah, since 1993. So it's hopefully going to be a place where, you know, and anyone can make an account and add stuff or edit things and whatnot. So we're hoping that that's going to be a space where, again, we can give back to the community and kind of mature the share of information, because the academic space has citations and bibliographies and DOIs and everything. A lot of times you see some talk that was given by someone with a fake name and you have no idea and it's gone. And so we're hoping to try to kind of capture that and help each other, everyone learn from those.
Fantastic. So does the research ever inform what Thinxt itself does?
Yeah, I mean, I think Thinxt Labs, in addition to Thinkscape, that's kind of our main deliverable. But another thing we do is we do a lot of both internal and external research. We try to keep Thinxt as an organization constantly learning. So we have a kind of a Thinxt project kind of incubator where any employee in Thinxt can switch their day job to work on a research project. We just had an engineer come off of that and he was doing machine learning for Paddle, which is a game that I had never heard of. That's sort of like pickleball. Everyone at Thinxt, I'm sure, will groan if they hear that, but it's basically slightly faster pickleball. But looking at how you can use computer vision from a single camera to be able to track people playing in a 3D space with different objects. And that was something that they were passionate about. And so we gave them a space and the research environment for that. Whether or not that turns into product kind of remains to be seen. But we've definitely been looking at, for example, the growth of CICD attacks. So looking at people moving kind of into the action space, the runner space, looking at pivoting through and doing either source code manipulation or build time configuration attacks. And, you know, we've been looking at that very heavily. So we're working on CICD tokens. So continuing our quest to make everything that an attacker might want potentially a risky click for them. And so we're hopefully going to be able to speak more about that soon.
Jacob Torrey, head of labs at Thinx, thanks a lot.
Very cool. It's nice to put a face to a voice.
Thanks a lot, Jacob.